Just before we get into the interview with Aidan Killian, there's a couple of things I need to explain that he talks about in our chat that if you're not from Ireland, you mightn't be familiar with. He talks about VHI, which is a medical insurance company. He talks about Meteor, which is a mobile phone provider. He talks about eFlow, which is a road toll company. And he talks about AIB, which is one of the larger banks here in Ireland. Right, so that said, here's my chat with Aidan. Okay, so I'm very happy to be talking to Aidan Killian today. Aidan is a former investment banker from Ireland who went on to become a stand-up comedian. And he has a new book coming out called Dear Plonker, which chronicles his correspondence with large corporations and institutions. And we'll be getting into that a bit more during our conversation. So, hiya, Aidan. It's very nice to be talking to you.
Hi, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
How long have you been doing comedy, Aidan?
I think I did my first gig in 2007, but I only took it seriously since maybe 2009. So that's really 7 years giving it my best.
Okay. And how long were you doing banking before that?
5 years before. You know, I did finance in college, got a job in investment bank in Ireland, ended up in Tokyo, did a few years out there. So about 5 years in total. And then bought some properties and shares and all that stuff, and then lost it all. And through that process, I learned a bit about how to deal with these corporations.
And was your move away from banking, like, was it a gradual thing, or was like there one pivotal moment where you kind of went, that's it, I can't do this anymore?
I was thinking about it. You know, I kind of enjoyed it when I did it. I mean, there were huge hours, 80-hour weeks, sometimes more. And but I was young, you know, I was 26, had an apartment that cost $50,000 rent a year, and little toys like the caddy motorbikes and expensive restaurants every day. It was fun. It was a good experience at the time. But then I got this job as a trader in Hong Kong, and my boss wouldn't let me go for it, even though my contractor let me go. So it was really just a split decision. I just kind of went, oh, well, fuck you then, and then quit. So that was it. And then I just decided to become a comedian. I mean, I was doing comedy at that stage as a hobby, and I just said, well why not? Because I predicted, well, my mentor really, Steve, we've been discussing that the banking system was going to collapse at that time. So either he was right and it was going to collapse and I'd have a head start doing what I wanted to do in life, comedy, or I wouldn't collapse, and if I wanted, I could always go back to it anyway. I had plenty of friends in banking, right? So.
And were you right on the money, like, for when the crash happened?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give him all the credit for that. But yeah, it was pretty much spot on. He was shorting bear at 138. It went down to 2, I think. I don't know what he got out of, but yeah, he made a packet.
What does that mean?
It means that he bet on it going down, and he made money that it did because he was right.
Oh, right. Okay. Are you still in touch with them?
Yeah, now and again, he's off in Bali. I hang out with Steve. I went to his 40th birthday, and I see pictures of his kids now and again. But yeah, he's living a nice life now. He's just kind of semi-retired, hanging out in Bali, surfing, and now and again looking at the internet to play with the markets.
Right.
Well, I'm working hard, writing jokes, trying to save this country and the whole wide world. I'm on it, John. I've got this.
Okay. So why do you think laughter exists?
It's just an audible expression of merriment, right? Well, actually, for loads of reasons. If I was to answer it in one word, I'd say connection.
To what?
To each other. Because we laugh when we realise something. You know, you get something and you see it, and if someone else gets it too, you're like, oh, yeah, we get this. And it's also a release of tension. You know, if a lion chases you and me back in the old days when we lived in caves, and we just get away from the lion and escape by the skin of our teeth, we'll probably burst out laughing because all that tension will be there. Like, I saw that before. There were some girls outside Temple Bar, and they were crossing the main road near outside the old central bank. And half of them ran across the road and were on the island, and the other half weren't there yet. and they ran out, but there was a bus there, and they didn't see behind the bus, and there was a car, and the car rammed on the brakes, beep, and I literally missed them by like inches, and then all of them burst out laughing. But yeah, it's more of a like, hey, we're okay, hey, you know, we saw what happened, and yeah, I don't know, that's my best answer for now, but I'd have to think about it, John. Maybe I'd come up with a better answer if I thought about it.
Right, because there's a lot to it. Like most things in life are very practical. You can kind of go, oh, there's a reason for that. And yeah, there is this thing about release. But there's lots of layers to laughter and why people laugh. And like you could look at it on the surface and go, well, it's quite an impractical kind of thing. We don't actually need it. You know, it's like an appendix or something like that. Well, we do need our appendix, but you know what I mean.
Impractical? What do you mean? Merriment, happiness, joy is impractical. I mean, human beings are impractical.
In what way?
Well, I mean, what do you mean? Practical? We don't need laughter to make money, but we need laughter to be human beings. That's a big part of us. Well, without laughter, we'd be like Germans or something. Semi-human robots who've beaten the crap out of the Greeks.
So, is comedy an art?
I think so. I see it as an art. It wouldn't be. I mean, a lot of artists don't recognise it as an art. I mean, the Edinburgh Fringe, don't forget, was a theatre festival, and they wouldn't let comedy into it. And that's how the Edinburgh Fringe started up, because they did their own thing, and then the Edinburgh Fringe, of course, became bigger than the actual theatre festival.
Yeah, yeah. Say with, you know, painting and sculpture and all that kind of thing. Like, there's a lot of stuff goes on behind the scenes. There's a lot of practice and structure and, you know, the go to make the painting or the sculpture or whatever. Is it the same with comedy? Like, is there a lot of boring stuff goes on behind the scenes, and all we get to see is the end product on stage?
Yeah, I mean, I heard Des Bishop say once, for new people to practice the same set, say 200 times, same 7 minute set 200 times. Jerry Seinfeld spends years crafting one joke, and we'll do the same joke for 15, 20 years. But we need to remember, comedy is a very, very big umbrella. It's not like, it's like music, right? All the different types of music. So this is not a dig at Michael McIntyre, but Michael McIntyre, he's very popular, right? So he'd probably go into like the equivalent of like popular music, whatever really popular music is at the moment. Whereas, you can't really say Michael McIntyre is the same as Billy Connolly or Tommy Tiernan or Frankie Boyle. These people are all themselves, and whatever they do being themselves makes people laugh. So my theory is that you can take any human being, get them to do stand-up comedy. That does not mean they can be a professional comedian, but they can certainly do 3-4-5 minute piece and make an audience laugh, because everybody's interesting. Everybody has their own unique personality, so you learn the structure of comedy, put that in with your own life, talk about who you are, and give an interesting speech. Like, you often see best men speeches being funny, right? Yeah. Just as funny as stand-up comedy. Now, they're not always funny. Sometimes they're crude and horrible, but often they're surprisingly good.
Yeah.
Right? Because they put the work in, and they've learned it off, and they spent hours and hours practicing, standing in the mirror, getting the timing right, ending on the punchline, connecting the next bit to the piece before, using callbacks, tools that they're using that they probably aren't even aware of what they're actually doing.
Right. Because you teach comedy as well, don't you?
I have done, yeah. I don't really do it so much anymore because I'm focusing on my comedy, but yeah, I put a course together, and I got basically professionals, because when I was in Tokyo, I used to have to go to a meeting every single morning. And being Irish, growing up in a society where we're told not to stand out, probably because our grandparents and great-great-grandparents would have, you know, been killed for having eye contact with their lords, with their masters, you know. Yeah. I don't know why, but in school I remember being very, very embarrassed if I had to speak out loud, going red. And I would not have been shyer than most people. But it was this no one wanted to be the person having to stand up and answer the question. And so on. So when I got to Tokyo and had to do this meeting, all these Americans and French were ultra confident. And I was quite young. I was only 24, 25, 26 kind of age. So even when I knew what I was talking about, I was a bit embarrassed. And I did not like looking embarrassed because it seems weak. And you don't get paid for coming across as timid or meek or weak in bank. So I wanted to master it. So I did stand-up comedy so I could learn how to present myself effectively. And it worked, because if you can do stand-up comedy, well, then obviously doing a normal presentation is easy in comparison, because you don't have to make anyone laugh.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I heard a scriptwriter saying the same thing. He was stuck on something, so he went and did stand-up comedy, kind of pushed himself out into it, and that really helped his writing.
Well, you're forced, because you've got a deadline. You've got to stand up on stage and you've got to be funny, and you can't fake comedy. You can't fake martial arts. You walk into the ring, you can't bluff it. They're going to kick the crap out of you if you don't know how to defend yourself. And likewise, on stage, if you go up there, they're not going to laugh. And that silence is going to hurt you. So you need to know what you're doing.
Right. I heard a female comedian saying that the first 2 years, it really doesn't matter what you say. Because you're just getting comfortable with being on stage, and then after the first 2 years, that's when what you say actually really starts to matter. Do you think that's right?
For me, I didn't do anything yet for 2 years. I didn't talk about anything of interest. I just wanted to be able to be funny and not die on my ass and get comfortable. Yeah, maybe even three. I suppose around the third year. Yeah, that's right. Whoever said that? Who said that?
I can't remember her name. She's the lady who wrote Two Broke Girls. She's written a few things, a few sitcoms, but she's a stand-up comedian in her own right.
Okay, well, I agree with that. It was about my third year when I wrote Take the Red Pill, which took on the banking crisis, maybe even my fourth year, really. And that was the first time I had anything of value to say and made it funny. And then after that, I pretty much... Now I'd never say a joke unless I had something behind it. That's me. That's not the same for everybody now. That's the way I do comedy. Every line that I say is not... I'm not there to entertain the audience. I don't give a shit if you laugh, right? Mine is because I want to say something, and then I make it funny afterwards. So right. The audience laughing comes second for me. It's way more important that I have to be able to stand by what I say and not, like, 50 years from now, look back and go, oh, well, actually, yeah, the reason the world is shit was partially because I was adding to it by, you know, punching downwards or being misogynist or racist or, you know, elitist or whatever, you know.
So. Yeah. So who are your comedy heroes?
I love Bill Hicks and right. Lenny Bruce and George Carlin and Steve Hughes. He's still alive. I like Steve Hughes. And who else? I love Tommy Tiernan, actually. I love Tommy Tiernan.
Right.
Every time I watch Tommy, it's just, there's something about him. He just awakens a little bit of wildness inside me. Whereas, you know, Bill passed on the message. He really, it was really beautiful. That was real art. Bill Hicks' stuff, that's real art. Carlin was just a political tyrant shouting, you know, by the end, da 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 da. But the rhythm of it was it was beautiful, Papa. And he really was saying stuff and he really cared about it. And then Lenny Bruce, he broke the mold, didn't he? He was Lenny Bruce. I don't think he was even a comedian anymore. It was just Lenny Bruce breaking the matrix of the system and peeling back the lies and standing for truth and ultimately dying for it, right?
Right. Okay, so just get on to your book now. As I said at the beginning, your book, Dear Plonker, it's a collection of your correspondence with large corporations and institutions. And the majority of these interactions that you had, you managed to avoid paying the fees that you're being asked to, and in some cases you were compensated. So as well as funny, it's practical. So for someone listening to this podcast who gets the scary letter or the intrusive phone call, what are the basic principles of your approach when dealing with these large corporations and institutions?
I've taken a lot of different approaches throughout my time at this, and there's many ways to skin a cat or to beat a corporation. So I wouldn't give any one way. In the book, what I do is I experiment. For me, by the way, I did this book as a gift to people of Ireland. I'm busy with my comedy. That's what comes first, and that's what I care about. For me, it was like I'd already done this stuff. I know I can do it. I've helped other people around me, and I know they can do it. But the fact is, we, the people of Ireland, are sheep. We're scared, timid little slaves that will end up paying the Irish water And we do what we're told. I mean, they closed off the roads to us and didn't let us protest, and we didn't kick them down. Now, I'm not saying there should be violence, but by God, closing off the roads and let people protest, that's terrifying. What, are we just going to stop protest altogether like in Spain? I mean, this is Orwellian stuff, unless people make a stand. So for me, with this is like, I've broken it down and I've used humor because people are lazy. They don't want to have to learn how to do it. So I've shown how I've done it in each particular case. I've taken on VHI and they said they wouldn't pay me. Ultimately, they gave me 25 grand in the end. I've taken Meteor phone company because they sent me a text message saying advertising a product. I'm not a consumer. I'm not some sort of, but I don't consent to the world advertising to me against, you know, my consent. So I would never agree to that. So if they send me a text message, I could let it go, or I could inform them. So I did my duty to inform them what they've done is wrong, because they've wasted my time, and my time is precious. It's my life. You made me pick up my phone, look at it, and be disappointed that it wasn't a friend. It was just some crap advert. So I wrote to them and said, I'm not paying you the bill. They didn't agree. And I said, look, I don't care what you agree to. I care about the facts. I will go to any international court and stand and accept the consequences of perjury because I don't lie. Will you? They don't answer the question, of course. And I said, look, I'm not paying you the bill. And if you cut me off, I'm going to hold you financially responsible in the court of law. So they eventually agreed. Now, once they've agreed, they've accepted it as a precedent, as they call it, right? As in like a first case. So they've agreed that they were wrong. So I say, okay, cool. I accept your apology. If you do it again, I will bill you 100 euros per text. So I've let them know my terms and conditions here. I've said, look, I don't agree to you sending me stuff, but if you do, I want 100 euros per text because I'm willing.
That's my 100 euros was like what you quantified your time.
That's it. I prefer no text, but if they're going to do it, I'll take 100 euros. Okay. If you can send as many as you like, if you give me 100 euros per text, I don't care. I'll be interrupted. That's my price. Some people would think, like, if you're a big CEO of a company on hundreds of millions a year, probably 100 euros per text wouldn't be enough for you. Bill Gates apparently is so rich that it wouldn't be worth his time to pick up 20 euros, right? Because he'd be making more money. So maybe he'd need more money. But for me, my price is 100 euros per text. I will accept as many of your texts as you like on condition you pay me 100 euros per text. They don't agree in writing. And I write back to them and said, again, I'm not interested in your opinion. I'm interested in fact, full truth, full honor. I stand in and I want my money, 100 euros per text if you do it. Three more texts come. John, three more texts. What were they thinking? Why couldn't they just fix their system? I don't know. I don't know why they didn't. Whatever their excuses were, ultimately they owed me 300 euros. So my bill went up and they said I owed them money, blah, blah, blah. We fought each other with different letters, emails, whatever, and I documented it. And in the end, of course, they pay me my 300 euros and apologize. Now, this is like, for me, it's a waste of my time. It's a waste of my time, John. I could be out in nature. I could be hanging out with my family. I could be trying to, you know, to connect with strangers, practicing my comedy. But at the same time, I know there's a lot of people out there who get these crappy bills for 40 euros or 100 euros, and they're right. But they can't afford a solicitor, they can't afford a barrister, they don't want to go to court, and they don't know how to deal with it. So you can just copy what I've done if you like, and you can beat them. So that's that. Then I have the solicitors, debt collectors, banks, eFlow. I hammered eFlow, TV license, I humiliated them, and I make it funny. I mean, I'm not being funny now because I'm being serious, but in the letters, I realize that it's serious stuff. So I actually end up, I use humor in it. People are amused when they read them.
One of the things I saw you saying was to not engage with them on their terms, to shift the terms so that they're on the engagement is on your terms. Is that right?
Because if you're a footballer, if you play Gaelic football and you're a professional Gaelic footballer, and then somebody says, oh, you're good at sport, come on over here into the karate ring and fight the karate champion of Japan, you're not going to win no matter how good you are at sports because you're playing different rules. Likewise, the Japanese black belt in karate is not going to be good at Gaelic on his first go because you're stepping into a different world. So if they try to get me to ring them on their phone and they keep me waiting for 45 minutes, and then if I do get through, I get through to somebody who's in a foreign country, and this is not in any way disrespectful to anyone from another country, but I say to the company that I'm dealing with, if I'm ringing in Ireland, I want to speak to somebody in Ireland with some authority, some power that they're able to deal with the situation. If I'm talking to someone in, I don't know, some country that I barely ever heard of, to a person who I'm finding difficult to understand, we've got a situation here, because what's going to happen is my temper, my annoyance, my frustration, my disappointment will be overwhelming, and I'll just give in, break down, and give them what they want. I'll just take the money. I can't handle it anymore. So if we can use the same policy back to them, make their life difficult, give them questions, give them homework, write to the CEO, send them a registered letter, keep a carbon copy of it, send it to them and say, I want to the person who I write to find out the CEO's name. Ring them up. Who's the CEO's name? They don't want to tell you. So they'll do everything they can not to tell you. Get their name. Are you this call is being recorded. Are you refusing to give me the CEO's name? What are you hiding? If you've got nothing to hide, why are you fear? If you've got nothing to fear, use the same stuff back on them. Get it right to them and say, I demand that you give me a handwritten letter back, or else I won't do business with you. Now, in a court of law, you've given a fair and reasonable offer. You're being reasonable. They're the ones not being reasonable. But you can, if you play by their rules, you're just going to break down, unless you've got the patience of a saint, which I know I don't. That's why I don't do it.
It's really funny listening to you, because it sounds like, on the one hand, it's like really obviously common sense what you're saying. But then on the other hand, it's like outrageously a different approach. I'm not sure if that's that, like, we're just conditioned to just, you know, well, that's just the way it is. It's just, you know, you just have to, life's too short to be fighting over 40 euro. But of course you're right. And that's like what I found so refreshing about the way you went. I mean, it's a bonus that you actually succeeded. But the approach is really refreshing, I think, anyway.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah, well, I'm getting good feedback and people are really enjoying it. And a few people have read it, started sending their own letters. And one guy's already had a victory and it's only been out a week, so that's nice.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Yeah. So the other thing I really liked about it was that rather than just, because you could be just, you know, you've probably met people who are they're just contrary. They just love having arguments and they're just, you know, they're just difficult. But that's not what your approach is about. The thing I liked about it was that you're talking about from a personal perspective, because when you get the letter or the phone call or whatever, the immediate reaction is fear. So like it's the personal work of turning that fear into something more positive. That works for you and even for the person who you're talking to on the phone or who you're corresponding with. Have I got that right?
Yeah, right. Turning fear into fun is one of the phrases I use, because it is terrifying. I still get scared when I get letters. I'm not, you know, and I'd be scared if policemen turn up at my house or they get threatened with solicitors and they write these big words. I'm less afraid now, to be honest with you, but I certainly was. So how do I deal with that? So I start asking them questions. So I don't say I'm not going to pay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to be reasonable. If I feel it's ultimately my fault, and it truly is, well, then I'll meet them in a fair and reasonable manner. But I refuse to be bullied, and I refuse to act from a place of fear, because I think that's very dangerous. When people act from a place of fear, I don't think it's in their own interest or the interest of anybody in this world. So what I try and do is I ask them questions. Like, I'm just going to pull up a letter here. So I might ask them questions like, can you provide me with all the documented evidence that you're relying upon to make this claim within 7 days of receipt of this letter? That's a very simple statement, John, right? Mm. I'm just asking them to provide me the documented evidence that they're relying upon to make the claims that they're making. Now, that means I want all of the information they're relying upon. Now, if they don't have that information, that means it's hearsay. It means they're just a company that are making money, threatening people, or using threatening letters without backing it up. If they don't have any evidence. So I don't know if they do or not. But if someone writes me a letter, I'm going to ask them some questions and I'm going to give them a chance to be honorable and to provide me the information. Now, if they do, fair enough. Who knows? I might just pay them the full amount. But that hasn't happened yet. Hasn't happened with the TV license, hasn't happened with solicitors, hasn't happened with anyone. They haven't provided me anything. They've just been used big words. I asked them to write clearly and honestly. I asked them, the people who signed the letter, they don't even sign it. I followed up with them. I wasn't able to speak to them. I don't even know if the people who signed the letter exist. I couldn't hunt them down.
Were these letters signed in pen or that thing where they just, it's almost like a photocopy of a signature, written
signature? Photocopy. Oh, right, yeah. It's just meaningless, just photocopy. It's nothing. It's like, it's kind of like, you know, those email scams that they send out, where they send out millions. Hello, I'm a Nigerian. I've got 10. They send it to everybody. It's not just for you. They send it to the occupier, Mr. Killian or Mr. Number 5. What is this? This is just spam. John, it's just spam. You're spamming my letterbox. Now, I don't get much mail anymore, but I used to get a lot. I just don't. What I do is sometimes I take back all my junk mail, which I don't get anymore, like Domino's, leaflets, other bills. And I put them all, crumple them up, put some stones in it, and return to sender. Now, the reason I put in the other stuff is so they have to pay for the postage, because you've got to pay for the postage if it weighs something when you return it back to them.
All right.
Yeah.
So. Do you bother to read all through the terms and conditions that you would have agreed to at the beginning, you know, or do you just not bother with that and just go straight into the dialogue with them?
It depends what we're talking about. And nowadays, I'm very careful what I sign. So,
I'm thinking about, like, you Facebook. Know, like even no. something like iTunes or online, you know, that this like 54 pages of terms and conditions comes up, and I don't think most people bother to read it, because it's just like, I haven't got the energy to go through all that, because in 2 months they're going to update it and I'll have to read the whole thing again. So you just accept and go on. And it's I think in a written thing, you'd probably be a bit more, but a lot of contracts are done online in that kind of way. I just wondered about how you deal with the terms and conditions.
That's a nightmare. No, I don't read through 54 pages of nonsense. But I do remember reading that like minds can contract. Now, that means that you can't contract with a dog. We're not allowed to contract with someone under 18 because they're not like minds. You're not allowed to contract with someone who's drunk or high. So they've got to be like two, you know, capable minds. Mind right. meets mind. Now, a corporation is a dead entity. It's an idea. A corporation is not a human being. I am a human being. So can a human being have a contract with a corporation? No. No, they cannot. Now, you think, but of course they can, because, you know, I've signed deals with Vodafone and Meteor and my company and blah, blah, blah. But it's actually different, because I remember when I had I didn't have a company, but I had an idea that was acting as a company, Laugh Out Loud. It was a small comedy club. It's still around every weekend on show. Every weekend on show, 9 p.m. It's good fun. But it's not a business. It's pay what you like. We don't make money at it, but it's a good comedy club. But I used to want to do deals with the independent.ie, Dennis O'Brien's evil newspaper, or whatever it was. It was the Heralder. They had a grab one deal. And in the grab one deal, I wanted the customers to come to the comedy club, because it would make it more fun. But I had to sign a contract with them. And I said, but I don't have a company. They wanted a company name, and I didn't register the company because that didn't appeal to me. And I said, I can't do that. And they said, well, hang on. And they got back to their boss and they said, oh, as long as you sign your name, just put your name in capitals there and your address, you know, we can deal with you as a company. Now, that's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. It is interesting, but I'm missing the significance. What does that mean?
So I think, right, so I'm acting as a company there. So Aidan Killian is acting as a company. So Aidan Killian is acting as a company, and they're trading with Aidan Killian, and that's the agreement. So they can deal with the company. Company meets company, because they need the contract.
Yeah.
Right, they need a person to sign it. So me and you, John, we could have an agreement, human meets human. But I don't think that in a court of law, I think it can only be Aidan Killian, the person, the legal entity, which I'd be representing, contracting with a corporation. So all of those things, when you sign with iPads or iPhone, whatever, you sign those big, long 54 things, you're signing it as a company. Now, my understanding is that companies have less rights than human beings. So, yeah, I would sign it as the legal entity, Aidan Killian, but I, Aidan Killian, reserve all the rights as a human being, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, I think so. And you think that that is how you were able to do some of the things that you did, like say with Meteor and eFlow and...
No. Like I kept it very simple. I just look at with eFlow, I just asked questions. I just said, look, did you use any public funding for this road? If so, how much? Is it true you're allowed to demand money? Are you allowed to demand money from human beings? And then I quoted, you know, the law to them about you're not allowed to demand fines and forfeitures until it's proven in the court of law. And I quote the law and I write it back to them. Does this apply to you? Are you claiming it doesn't apply? They don't answer my questions. And if they don't answer my questions, they're trying to hide something. So I give them another chance. And I write the questions again. And I say, if you do not answer my questions, it's accepted that there is no debt and you guys are acting as criminals.
Right.
Now, that's very interesting because I'm saying, I will, you know, you're not, if you answer my questions, I'll deal with you. If you fail to answer my questions, what do you want me to do here? I'm asking you, are you allowed to demand monies? You're not answering. Silence is acquiescence, as they say in a court of law, the maximum of law, silence is acquiescence. They agree if they're being silent. So they're agreeing that they're criminals. Now, obviously, John, I'm not the type of guy to do business with criminals, so I don't pay them. Here, I'll give you this. There's a lot of, there might be people listening there who are worried about eFlow because they forgot to pay it because they were too busy because they had a life, or maybe they had a date and they didn't pay it, or they tried to pay it and something happened. And they're good people and they want to do the right thing, but at the same time, they don't want to pay 40 euros or 150 or whatever the fine is. If you write to them, get a postal check or something, and send them the original amount of 310 or whatever it is, then you're going to, most likely they'll accept it. That's what they did with my experiments. I didn't always pay them the 310, but sometimes I did because I wanted it. Because I know the likes of my mum, she would be the most obedient, good person. And most people I know, they want to pay their taxes. They want to pay everything. They do. I do too. I want to contribute towards the society that I'm in the best way possible. But what I don't want to do is I don't want to get bullied and pushed around by corporations that are trading for profit, that are sponging and just squeezing and just taking everything and giving nothing in return, leaving this country to be like a fraction of what it could be. And I don't want to pay for the pillars of society that are used to control us in a way that's not for our benefit, because I don't think that's the right thing to do. But if you're out there and you want to do the right thing and so on, but at the same time you don't want to pay 100 euros, pay them the original amount and let's see if they still force you to do the rest. Or you could just buy my book.
So what do you think are the top things like that people don't know, but would be really helpful if they did know when they're dealing with these institutions and corporations?
Like, I mean, I've listed a bunch of laws in here that I've used throughout it. But now at this stage, I don't even have to use any law, John. That's the thing. I mean, I've talked about the Data Protection Act, Non-Fatal Offence Against the Person Act, the Criminal Justice Act, Criminal Justice Theft and Fraud Offences Act, the Gary Doyle Order, Bill of Exchange Act, Bill of Rights Act, European Convention of Human Rights. I've talked about all of these in the book and broken them down and put it in such a way that they could be used by the common person, the common man or woman. But for me now, I think the most important thing is to be able to have the courage to stand up against these guys. And even if that's just an experiment, maybe it's an experiment with the eFlow, go through eFlow, which isn't even an Irish company, by the way, it's a French company. Go through eFlow and don't pay it. And your fine's going to be 12 euro. So risk 12 euro. That's the first fine for a week. And go in and just don't pay them for 24 hours and then see if you can get away with the original amount. Ask them some questions first and give them 3 days or 5 days to respond to your questions. Ask them here. I'll find some of the questions that I've asked them here in one of my letters. I mean, you can ask your own questions. These are just questions that I came up with. So there's no right or wrong ones. But here's some. I'll just read some of the questions in my letter to eFlow. You stated that there was a total amount due. Please provide document evidence that any money is lawfully owed. Provide a lawful valid signed contract. Also send me a signed invoice bill signed with a blue wet ink signature. If you cannot or will not do this, we accept that there is in fact no debt owed and this is a scam. 2. Under what authority are you claiming that we must pay fines even though we have not been found guilty by a court of our peers? Or are you claiming that the law does not apply to you? Are you claiming that eFlow is above the law? 3, you stated that it must be paid and there will be an additional charge of €41 per journey. Isn't it true that your statement constitutes an offence against the Non-Fatal Offences Against the Person Act 1997 because you're demanding monies, alleged monies, with menace and malice? And that's not very nice. 4. There's 6 of these, 7 of these. 4. I read on the interweb that the road has already been paid for. Can you confirm that for me, please? What is the total amount of monies collected from the toll up to this date? How much did the road cost to build? 5. Was any public funding used for the creation of this road? 6. We only correspond to human beings. If you wish to correspond with us and continue our pen pal relationship, it's essential that you introduce yourself. Who are you? Tell me a bit about yourself. What are your hobbies? 7. What's the name and contact details of your CEO? And then, bam, the letter goes on and on and on. And I put law on it. And then, but I'm nice. At the end of the law, at the end of the letter, I sign off. We wish you all a Merry Christmas at eFlow. And we hope you find a loved one under the mistletoe and you become filled with joy and festive jollies. Love and light, King Aidan.
Very good. That's kind of one of your approaches as well, is to kind of do the reverse of what they do when they put you on hold for 40 minutes or 50 minutes and wear you down. Is like your letters are very long in some cases for that specific reason. Is that right?
No. Sometimes they're not. Just sometimes they're the questions. If I have lots of questions, they're not always long. Sometimes I don't have any questions. Sometimes I only have 2 or 3. But it is. I do try and be human with them. At the end of the day, they're a human being doing a job, and they're probably doing a job because they need money, because they're in the society and they want to be able to feed themselves or their loved ones. So they're in. They're just the same as me. I don't really know any more than them. Maybe a tiny little bit more about this because I've experimented with it. But this is just for me. It's just a game. It's just a game that happened to have worked. And there's a lot of people out there who are really struggling. I did a tour of Ireland about 2 years ago and I met a priest. And he said he thinks that there's one person in every parish in this country that have taken their own life due to the depression. Now, I know I'm not saying that all depression is related to money, certainly not. But he was talking about in relation to financial issues caused by the banks and their corruption.
Yeah.
And that really hit home with me because I was talking about it at the time. I went from town to town, I realized there's a lot of truth in this. And a lot of people opened up and said to me, the ones that obviously didn't take their own life because they were still alive, they said, you know, they pondered that.
Yeah. I'd say that's gone up now, even since like, if that's 2 years ago.
Maybe. And don't forget, we've lost at least 50,000 people of our brothers and sisters every year leaving the country because there's no work for them here.
Yeah.
You know, so this country's really, really taken a hard hit. And this book isn't going to save us, unfortunately, but I do believe it's a step in the right direction. Because it's funny, it's easy to read. It's very basic, anybody can understand it. And I really think it's just like one step. Once you take one step, that's it. Because you'll have a little victory and then you'll do the next one. And before you know it, you'll be taken on the banks with credit card. I've taken my banks, I've 3 chapters on the credit card debt. In that one, they're completely corrupt. I mean, my family said, Aidan, you spent the money, you should pay them back. Otherwise, you're robbing them, right? Now, that is a very serious statement, right? Because I'm not a thief. I don't consider myself a thief. And I could pay them back. I have the money to pay them back, John. I could pay them back if I wanted. But I've made a conscious decision not to. Because I asked the bank questions and they failed, refused, or neglected to answer those questions. And as far as I can see from the case that I've built up, and I've published in this book, so I'm not hiding anywhere, and my name's on the back of it, so they can, it's all there. I've made it as clear and honest and as truthful as possible. And they have not given me the documentation that I require. Now, maybe they've lost it, but people always say, yeah, Aidan, but you spent the money. So I spent what money? I spent the money that they facilitated me, but as far as I can see, they're not at a loss. They won't sign an invoice to say they are. If they sign me an invoice and give me my original signed contract back, I will happily do business with them and I'll sit them down and meet them in a reasonable manner. But if they turn up at my house and they threaten me, or if they send me letters and they threaten me, I have to stand up for myself. Who else is going to do it? And I will see them in court. If they want to go to court, I'll represent myself and I'll go there and I'll do my best. But don't just send me letters and expect me to bend over. I'm not like I'm not a slave to some company trading for profit. That's, you know, be piss off, AIB.
How far do you have to be willing to go with these to win with the institutions?
Well, my stance is that if I don't take on battles, I'm going to lose. And by the way, I'm not that difficult. I even have one of those eFlow things. In the car. What do you call those things?
I don't know the name of them. They're like the electronic little tag, yeah. Isn't it?
Tag scanner, so they can tell where I am and how many times I go through it. Because I got one of those, because my job is not to take on every battle in this world. I just did this to see what could I get away with, what is real, what are these guys getting away with. And that's why I wrote the book, and I've documented it. But I don't pay the banks because I think that they're liars. I've proven in my letters that they're criminals, and I don't want to support them. I try and deal with them as little as possible. I do have a bank account to make my life easier, but I don't leave much money in there because I don't want them using it against the highest good. So I do have one of those tags because I don't want to be fighting eFlow all of the time. I don't pay the TV license. I don't have a TV, but I just don't want to answer their questions. I don't fill in a census because I don't want to sign it and I don't want to contribute or support it. So basically whatever comes to me, unless it's just one simple question, is this in the interest of the highest good to do or not? If it's not, it goes in the bin or it gets sent back to them. And if they've got a problem with that, well, fine, let's go to court.
Right. Well, I'm thinking about there's lots of people in foreclosure. There seems to be a spate of repossessions going on at the moment all over the country. So for people like whose homes are under threat, who are, you know, trying to find ways to hang on to them, you know, your kind of approach, as I say, is very refreshing, but there comes a point, like with everybody, where they're kind of go, oh, well, I'm not willing to do that. Like, I'm not willing to go to jail, or I'm not willing to go to court or whatever. Like, how far do you have to be willing to go, do you think, with these institutions and banks and that kind of thing to win?
Well, ultimately, there's a threat on your life. Because as we said before, a lot of people have taken their own life, and that number's possibly growing. And it's not like we're getting honest statistics out there. I mean, I looked up the statistics. They're in the book. I don't know them off by heart. But I remember it might be like three times the amount of road traffic accidents. And don't forget, there's always advertising about, you know, traffic stops and drinking driving. We don't see much helping us to be able to support ourselves against these institutions who are coming after us, and they will kick you out of your home, and they will leave you homeless, and they will trick you into getting to sign over different types of mortgages and signing over your property and signing over your rights. And most people do it because they want the easy life.
Yeah.
So how far are you willing to go to protect your own life? That's the real question. And John, I don't have an easy answer. It's not easy to protect your home. These bankers are trained. They know what they're doing. They have the best legal people out there. So it's not like you write one funny letter and that's it. It's not. And if I had a home now, I did lose a house against them. I delayed them for a few years, but I did lose it in the end. But that's before I knew what I know now. I think if I had a house in Ireland now, I could protect it. But literally, I would have sign outside. I would be hard against the banks. I'd be meeting them in person. I'd be learning every day. I'd be giving up drink. I'd be taking it deadly serious. I'd be in warrior mode, going to the gym, looking over everything they write, asking them questions, registered letters, going into the court, holding them responsible. I'd be onto the Common Law Society. I'd go to their any courses, any information they're offering. I'd look into that. I'd look at any other information I could out there, and I would not budge, and I would keep going, and keep going, and keep learning, and keep moving forward, and ultimately I'd try and win, and I might lose. And if I lost, well, I'd know that I gave it my best shot. But yeah. I promise you this, from where I'm standing with the information that I have, going to MABS, going to someone in the solicitor world is basically you're just giving away your home. And that's fine if that's what you want to do. But I don't see an easy way out except to fight it in every possible way.
Right.
I know that sounds a bit harsh. I mean, people probably wanted something easier there, but you can't just write a funny letter and expect them to give you a house worth $500,000, right?
True. Yeah. Well, I suppose the house is the most extreme side of it. I know.
It can't be done. I know many people have done it though.
Yeah. Yeah. You have this thing where you were talking about that your car was clamped and you took an angle grinder to it, and you ended up being arrested for a little while.
Kidnapped
by the cops. So when I was listening to that story, which is very funny when you're telling it, but I was thinking that, like, for some people, they wouldn't be willing to do that. They wouldn't be willing to get arrested. Now, for other people, they would. And that's really what that question is about, is like how, when you are in correspondence about these different things, do you think that you are just willing to go longer than they were, and that what became economically not viable for them to just continually have to deal with you?
Yeah.
There was an element of that in it.
A lot of people said that to me. They just said, Aiden, they put you into the weirdo pile and they just never want to deal with you. And ultimately they just let you off. And you know what? Maybe that's happened once or twice. But when you look at the bigger ones, when you look at like the VHI, that wasn't the case. They tried everything. You can see from the correspondence. It was €25,000. Why would they give me 25%? I was right. And they knew I was right, and they still didn't pay me. And they risked someone's life in it. You know, they showed negligence, a disregard for human life. And in a court of law, if I'd got that, you know, all my documentation, all my emails, and I'd got that into a court of law, the judge would have hammered them. Most likely, the judge would have hammered them, and they would have ended up having to pay a lot of money. A lot of money for what they did. They got off lightly with 25 grand. So I think that in some cases it's fine to be difficult and to get away with the 40 quid fine. I don't really see it as getting away with it. I see them as being the ones that are getting away with tricking people into paying ridiculous sums of money, which is undocumented and just madness. It's madness to pay €40 to use an e-flow, which is our road built by our people with our stones. And I'm not some sort of like sovereign free man who's like, oh yeah, but it's Ireland. But it's like it's just common sense. Paying €150 to use a road is insanity.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll change gears slightly now. Do you think meditation has helped you become a better comedian?
It's made me become a better human. I'm less reactive, and being less reactive is good. I'm also less. I need validation less from the audience or external beings. So if I'm on stage and something's not going my way because they're not listening or something, often I can just be okay with that. Whereas before, I might have had the need to get them to listen to me by putting them down or being funny and it's also made me think clearer. I meditated a lot last year. I did Vipassana, and I was doing probably not 2 hours every day, but a lot of the days I do an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening, and it really helped. I wouldn't say I had clear thoughts, but I could witness my thoughts and not let them run away with me, like an Alsatian. If you're taking an Alsatian for a walk, and the Alsatian's doesn't respect you, the Alsatian will run around, and you'll follow the Alsatian. And that's my mind.
Right.
And sometimes over the last year, I was able to walk along and the Alsatian respected me. Whereas now I haven't been meditating much, just 5-10 minutes a day. And my mind's going crazy, crazy. I'm doing a lot, books, and I'm making excuses. But I intend to. In fact, I was meant to be at a Vipassana 10-day retreat this week. But I have the Vodafone Festival. Did I just do a corporate ad for Vodafone? I did. Vodafone Festival this weekend. And I am going to be at it. I'm going to be at it. So I basically sacrificed my 10-day retreat in order to do a gig with some big comedians, which I'm really looking forward to. So, yeah, I could have just said yes, but I do. I think it helps you in any area of life. It helps me in all areas of life. And comedy being my passion, my labor of love, is definitely helped because of meditation.
Right.
Do you meditate? Do you meditate? Are you a meditator?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was a craniosacral therapist, or I still am, and that's pretty much, you have to meditate pretty much all the time to do that. So, yeah, spend a lot of time meditation.
Does that mean you go into people's head and play with their thoughts?
No, it's a palpatory skill. So you put your hands on people's bodies, with their permission, of course.
With their permission.
And you can feel when you damage yourself, and your body is fixing itself, it has a particular rhythm and feel to it. And if you can be still enough on the inside and you know what you're looking for, you can feel that with your hands, and then you can feel where it gets stuck, and you can sort of help it in the process that it's engaged in. But you have to be very still on the inside to really receive what's going on in the other person's body.
Okay, so, right. To be really, okay, I get it. I think I envision it.
Yeah, so to do that, like, you're sort of meditating 8 hours a day, pretty much, you know. It's very specific kind of stillness, but yeah, in essence it is, yeah. So yeah, I'm very, very familiar with the old meditation.
Okay, good.
How fragile are you?
That's an interesting question. People don't consider me fragile. I'm trying to picture when's the last time I was fragile. I was fragile a few years ago. 2 years ago, I had a little breakup and I was all emotional and needy and fragile. But I missed her, and I was all like, oh, boo, 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 boo. And but that passed after about probably a month or two. And then before that, I don't know. So
like on a scale of 1 to 10.
Just depends when you ask. Now I don't feel like, now I really feel I'm going with my flow. I'm feeling very invincible at the moment. Right. I'd say like I'm like a 9. I'm not trying to sound tough. I mean, I have my moments where I'm very low, but lately I'm really strong. I've been eating really well. I'm physically good. I'm mentally good, emotionally. I'm spiritually good. I'm really honored at the moment. So you're asking me when I'm at, you know, I'm at there and my book's published. I'm in the Vodafone Festival. I'm going to Edinburgh Fringe. I've been at, they're flying me over to Australia for a gig. So right now I feel kind of like, you know, super invincible, Aiden.
Very good. Where are you doing the gig in Australia?
The Freedom Summit. Freedom Summit.
What part of Australia is that in?
Byron Bay.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah. I used to live in Australia. That's why.
Okay, yeah, I don't know. I was only in Sydney once for a week passing through, so I don't...
You like Byron Bay. It's very nice beach.
It's quite expensive over there, though, right? I guess in Australia in general.
Yeah, well, Perth is particularly bad, but you're not going to be there. So I think Byron Bay will be all right, because there's kind of a big new age kind of hippie community there in Byron Bay. So the prices shouldn't be up too high, unless there's a lot of people coming in for the festival, in which case, like everywhere, everything will go up. Have you kept up with the whole financial markets thing? Do you keep an interest in it, or... Are you just interested from your own kind of from the work you're doing perspective?
I don't really. I mean, I was looking at the gold thing lately, and I was looking at the Greece, the coup in Greece, and but no, not really. I mean, I'm not investing. I have no currency to invest at the moment, and
right.
I'm really focused on what I'm doing.
Do you think there's another crash coming?
Yeah, I do. I hope I'm wrong. I'm okay with being wrong, but I remember when looking in the past, we're looking at a three-wave Fibonacci three-wave kind of thing from a technical point of view. So the second wave went down, and we're looking at one more big wave. But you know what? I'm really okay with being wrong on that.
What do you think people could do
now
to help make themselves more resilient for that if a crash did come?
That's a great question. Right. So... definitely learn how to shop. Learn how to shop in a way that's in your interest. That's healthy, proper, locally grown food, because your interest is the interest of all of those around you. Go to the markets, get to know the people, get your shop for the weekly there, right? So you're growing their, I'll call it business for the sake of the word, you're growing their business and then your own. So if in Ireland we had enough food to supply all of us, well, then it doesn't really matter, right? Because you always have enough food. So as soon as there's a food shortage, people panic.
Yeah.
Okay, so when we have access to healthy food, and this is Ireland, we could grow enough food to feed probably all of Europe or most of it. I mean, the point is, it's Ireland, it's green. Get a Ryanair flight to England and have a look at Ireland from the sky. It is just millions of land that's not even used. It's just sitting there. Mm-hmm. So there's no shortage. So get in a situation where you can have access to good, healthy food and water. So learn how to break that water meter thing as well. So once you have that, then how can you do it? I mean, have some access to silver and gold would be good if you could do that, because you're out of the currency, and have some paper cash. What else do you need to do? Because if you lose your job and you have no income, you have no paper anymore, right? You have no paper coming in. What would you do? How would you be? Like, my friend has lived without money, without even touching money for a year. How could you live without touching money? Or have some stuff that you could use if you lost your job? Because ultimately, if there's a recession, what happens is there's going to be way less paper in the air. So we've less paper and everyone's going to be fighting for it. So they take our real assets instead. They'll take your land. They'll take your houses, your car, whatever you let them take. And yeah. So that's it. So you've got to prepare. I don't have the answers really, except I know that I have silver hidden away for it if it happens. And I know that I shop in the markets. There's probably an awful lot more we can do. I know people live in squats, not because they're poor, just because they just don't want to pay rent money. And these places are nice. They really do them up, make them look beautiful.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, my daughter was telling me about some of them. Yeah, in Dublin. Sound good. Okay. Are you good with money yourself, do you think?
No, I overspend. I don't shop, but I eat out a lot, which is wasteful. Lately, I haven't been. But in general, I'm not great. I never was, actually. It's something I should... I suppose I just have, I find it so easy to make money. No, I do. I always have. I just... There's something... Even with comedy, I was able to make money. Whatever I do, I'm able to make money. I'm not saying, like, investment-wise, any investments I do will go wrong. But I'm always able to make enough that I can eat out regularly and, you know, enjoy myself.
That's good. And do you know how you can do that? Because a lot of people can't. And how you can make money so easily.
I just really believe it. So when I was a comedian, I wasn't very good. When I started off as a comedian, I only had 5 or 7 minutes. Now, you're not going to get paid money for 5 or 7 minutes. So then I started up with the presentation skills through stand-up comedy, and I worked on it. And I did so much stuff for free to every charity, every college, anybody who wanted to listen to me, I'd be there. And I'd do it until I became really, really exceptionally talented at what I did.
Yeah.
And anytime I saw a flaw or a mistake or anything like that, I'd look at it and go back, make it better so I didn't do it next time. And then I started charging money for it, and the people were very happy to pay me, so much so that they'd tell their friends. And I even offered 100% money back. I still do if I ever do a course on a storytelling course or comedy course, because I want people to have true value. I want them to tell their friends. I want them to advertise for me. I want them to love what I do and become better human beings because they spent that weekend with me. And they do. And that's the way it is. So they started giving me money. But then when I got more focused on my book, I didn't have make money for the last, you know, year with this book, writing this book and creating a new show. So I'm looking forward to having the next batch of a few grand. I want somebody to give me. Oh, yeah, they're flying to me Australia for a gig.
So who's they?
They is whoever is running the Freedom Summit.
Okay. Gee, that's nice, isn't it? It's nice to be, you know, be flown to another continent.
Yeah, so I'll get a few gigs out there for a few $100 and I'll come back and I'll spend it all in a wine bar. So I'll find some beautiful... Hopefully there's a beautiful woman listening to this and she's going to be inspired by the words that I speak. They're falling upon her ears like gentle drops of love, and she's going to contact me, and then we're going to go drink wine and make babies.
Great. Okay. Well, I'm glad to have been part of that.
Yeah, thanks for making that happen.
Anytime. You sound like you're quite health conscious, are you?
Yeah, a bit. Anytime I destroy myself by like drinking too much or smoking or doing drugs, I just come back and swing the pendulum the other way and make sure that I look after myself, because I get moody when I'm not healthy.
Okay.
And I prefer to be in good form. So I try and do stuff like meditate, eat well. Yeah, I think 80% of the time I'm really, really healthy with organic stuff. I don't eat any processed food or anything like that. But there's 20% of the time where I'm a demon. The demon runs amok. I do whatever the fuck I like. I go drinking and I take drugs and I smoke cigarettes and I eat Cadbury's chocolate. And I'm trouble to myself.
Well, you know, they say everything in moderation, including moderation. So
that's right,
I think that sounds all right. How do you... I heard you saying that you filter your tap water to get the fluoride out. Is that just a normal filter, or do you have some special filter to do that?
I actually have two filters. One filter I thought removed the fluoride, but apparently it only removes a small amount of it. It's a beautiful filter. It's called the Evo or something like that. Is it the Eva? But it doesn't actually get rid of it, to my knowledge. But it makes it, it does mineralize the water. It makes it taste delicious. And the other one is one of those reverse osmosis ones, which is attached to my sink. They're a little bit expensive, but it's worth it. It's worth it. You really feel a difference after a few weeks. It's quite amazing.
Okay, so last question. I ask this to everyone. If there's one thing you could pass on to future generations, what would it be?
Only one thing. There's so much. I would like to be able to contribute as much as possible to allowing them to be as free to be whoever they are. And then that's it. Freedom. I'd like to contribute towards freedom.
Brilliant. Okay, so how can people find out more about what you're doing, particularly that woman that you're going to fall in love with and make babies with?
Well, she can contact me on aidankillian.com. Now, there's not really much on the site, but buy the book. Buy the book, dearplonker.com.
So where can people buy the book?
I only put it in one bookshop for now because I only got it the other day in the bookshop in Donnybrook in Dublin. But it's probably better to get it online. So dearplonker.com.
Oh, it has its own website, does it?
And Common Law Society will post it out to you. They're the publishers. Contact me on... there's no point in me giving you my email. So just go onto Facebook or YouTube or one of these things or my website, which is aidankillian.com, and let's be friends and hang out and together create a better universe for all of us.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks very much for giving me your time, Aidan. It's been great to talk to you. I think what you're doing is great. I think you're helping people. And when people read your book and change their mindset and do this thing of turning the fear into a more positive thing, I think that's a real, really genuine, very practical public service that you're doing. And thanks on behalf of the Irish people. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Myself.
All right. Okay. Well, talk to you again then, Aidan. Thanks very much.
Be happy. Thanks for listening. Bye bye.
Okay. Bye.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti. We are the Argyle.